The title of this essay is Before Adam. It was originally presented on April 1, 1980 at Brigham Young University, and it later appeared in Nibley's book Old Testament and Related Studies. Before Adam. I am often asked by students, what about those people that live thousands of years before Adam? They usually ask after class and expect me to give a definitive answer before leaving the room. Why don't I bring up the subject in class? I did for 20 years, and then gave it up. It was a waste of time. Within the past 10 years, however, things have changed so much that it is time to resume the discussion, if only to reorient my own thinking on a subject that is impossible to avoid. The Latter-day Saints are the only Bible-oriented people who have always been taught that things were happening long, long before Adam appeared on the scene. They have never appreciated just how revolutionary that idea is. It does away with creatio ex nihilo, which, ever since the triumph of the school of Alexandria, has been for Christian and Jewish theologians alike the only possible definition of the word creation. In the April 1980 National Geographic magazine is a reproduction of a heroic relief sculpture on the wall of the so-called National Cathedral in Washington, D.C., showing 8 full-grown human beings popping out of a turmoil of cloud. It is entitled Creatio ex nihilo, Out of the Void. It should not be hard to confound such an absolute concept, since any alternative will do. And long before the time of Christ, the ancient sophists, supplanting religion by naturalism, came up with a scenario very close indeed to what we think of as evolution. And so we get at an early time, at the trial of Socrates, in fact, at which, incidentally, Socrates is the defender of religion, not the other way around. The side of an apostate religion squaring off against an always inadequate science. And the issue is never the merits of the evidence, but always the jealous rivalry of the contestants to see which would be the official light unto the world. Right down to the present day, we have been the spectators of a foolish contest between equally vain and bigoted rivals, in which it is a moot question which side heaps the most contempt on God's creatures. For the fundamentalist, to associate man too closely with God's other creatures was the supreme insult to God and man. Man, say the Christian theologians, faithfully following Aristotle, is the rational animal, the only rational animal. All other beings in nature are soulless, speechless, thoughtless, automata. Moreover, Adam was not only the only rational, immortal creation of God on earth, but the only intelligent actor on any solid world anywhere, being created out of nothing on the only inhabited planet in the entire universe, the solid earth, which was obviously the heavy center of everything, around which all other things revolved and onto which everything fell. Beside that, all was spirit. The evolutionists took the doctors at their word and had a very easy time showing that man shares so many visible qualities and traits with other animals that if animals are mere things, then so is man. Since they are able to survive and function simply as organisms reacting to an environment and nothing more, then man, being animal, has no more need of a soul than they have. The philosopher Arthur Schopenhauer, in his essay on the Christian system, said that the two fatal flaws of Christianity were, 1, denying spirit and mind to any other creatures but ourselves, which both fundamentalists and Darwinists do, and 2, allowing life to no other world but our own. Adam in a vacuum, all alone in the society of God's creatures, and all alone in the emptiness of space, the only thinking animal on the only inhabited spot in all the emptiness of space. When it began to appear that the earth was only one among countless possible earths, and not the one and only center of everything, the discovery was viewed by both sides as the fatal blow to the dignity of man and the integrity of the Bible. This has always amazed me. Why on earth should the idea of life on other worlds lead scientists to assume as a matter of course that such a situation renders God expendable and the Bible unacceptable? Such a conclusion follows only from the all-or-nothing premises of Alexandrian absolutism, the universe and truth and God could not be otherwise, by very definition, than as the doctors of the 4th century described them. Any changes in the scenario would require scrapping the whole thing, including God. It only shows, for Latter-day Saints, how strongly riveted were the creeds of the fathers, who have inherited lies upon the hearts of the children and filled the world with confusion. Strongly riveted, indeed. Those preconceptions were the very thing that Joseph and Brigham had the most difficulty in coping with among the saints, who cling to them to this day. This futile quarrel should be no concern of ours. For one thing, we have a story to tell before Adam. Religion and science have none, absolutely none. For the churchmen, the whole universe comes into existence in the week before Adam's own creation. But for the scientists, too, there is nothing to tell before the history. They set the stage for human history, but until a man with a book walks onto the stage, there is no story, no play. Science studies the properties and the sets for the play, but the set is the play. The medium is the message. There is no more to follow. All around us in the universe, things are just happening. If they didn't happen one way, they would happen another. What difference does it make? The scientists of past decades have been proud of the majestic meaninglessness of it all. Since this is not to be my subject, one quotation, the classical remark of Tyndale, will suffice. In the purely natural and inevitable march of evolution, life is of profound unimportance, a mere eddy in the primeval slime. The wise men gloried in the strength of mind and character that enabled them to look an utterly indifferent universe in the face without flinching. After all, they had tenure. Insisting that the rest of us rid ourselves of our infantile longings for more. When we visit the planets and their satellites today, what do we find? Nobody at home. Somewhere the side of a cliff slips and slumps. Somewhere dense clouds of dust are blown by super winds. Somewhere gas or magma seeps through cracks in the ground or huge blocks of ice collapse or collide. Somewhere a meteor lands without a sound. Somewhere. What difference does it make? It is all, as some of my professors used to remind their impressed but unhappy classes with malicious glee, utterly meaningless. Mount St. Helens takes on interest only because we are here. Globes on which nothing happens for millions of years are just as interesting as those on which change is taking place all the time. The static condition is in itself a happening, and with nobody around to measure the time, one scenario moves as fast as another. When science takes us to human prehistory, it is just more of the same. Since World War II, an immense lot of digging has been done all over the world, and the result is a great accumulation of properties, but still no play. We learn from what is being turned up that people lived in shelters of various kinds, ate food that they gathered or hunted, warmed themselves and cooked with fire, wore clothing as they needed it, had pots to cook and store food in, had children, drank water, breathed air, and so on. And that is the whole story. The table is now set for the banquet, but no live guests ever show up. We sit in the darkened theater waiting for the show that never begins. It won't begin until we get a written record. Listen to the latest word on the subject by one of the foremost prehistorians, A.J. Jelinek. The overriding impression of the technological evidence in the archaeological record is one of almost unimaginable monotony. The most overwhelming example is Olduvai Gorge, where for approximately a million years no significant innovation is discernible. Even the later innovations take place over hundreds of thousands of years. This means that we are talking about tens of thousands of generations of hominids maintaining patterns of technological traditions without discernible change. No Adam, no play. These can't be our people. Science promised an exciting new world, a great show to which H.G. Wells offered to conduct us, but it all went stale in his own lifetime. To paraphrase the eminent biologist René Dubos, existentialist nausea has found its home in the most affluent and technologically advanced parts of the world, The most poignant problem of modern life is probably man's feeling that life has lost its significance. The view that the modern world is absurd is no longer limited to the philosophical or literary avant-garde. It is spreading to all social and economic groups and affects all manifestations of life. I spend my days in the midst of noise, dirt, ugliness, and absurdity in order to have easier access to well-equipped laboratories, libraries, museums, and a few sophisticated colleagues whose material existence is as absurd as mine. I doubt that mankind can tolerate our absurd way of life much longer without losing what is best in humanness. It is religion that makes man humble in the face of nature, Dubow infers, and science that makes him arrogant, not the other way around. The humanists have always known that they have no play. Euripides has a little song to that effect, which he repeats no fewer than 5 times. What it says is, in effect, I know this play makes no sense, but neither does anything else. Shakespeare's last word on the subject in his last play, The Tempest, was, Our revels now are ended. These our actors are melted into air, into thin air. And like the baseless fabric of this vision, the cloud-capped towers, the gorgeous places, the solemn temples, the great globe itself, yea, all which it inherit shall dissolve, and like this insubstantial pageant faded, leave not a wreck behind. That's all there is. No one is going anywhere. Or take the highest achievement of modern theater, a play that won the Nobel Prize, no less. The characters in Waiting for Godot, writes an admiring critic, have nothing to say, nor have they anything to do. Language for them is a means for expressing the meaninglessness of existence. Godot is a symbol of hope that keeps man waiting for something big to happen, but that never happens. On the whole, all that man does centers round his physical needs and devices to kill time. Now, as to the past, when I first joined the Army, I was sent to weather school and became a weatherman, working with the primitive charts and diagrams of the day. Coordinating the information that came over the teletype from 100 other weather stations, I tried to report and predict the weather at Godman Field, Kentucky. Wouldn't it be wonderful, I thought in those days, if we had a movie that showed us all the moving storms and fronts? Then, instead of having to throw the models together with feverish haste to project the past into future weather, I would only have to look at the moving picture and know exactly what was going to happen tomorrow. Meteorologists can do that today. It is all before our very eyes on the evening news. Seeing is believing. We are going to be hit by a big one tomorrow, which turns out to be a beautiful day. Or that big clear spot shows perfectly heavenly weather ahead, so it snows and sleets all day tomorrow. Now imagine that instead of a weather eye, enabling such brilliant predictions a few hours ahead, we had a satellite picture showing the Earth over millions of years. Every time we stop the picture, we ask the scientist what is going to happen next. And so he tells us with great confidence. Can we trust him? We can check on the weather day by day and make corrections and adjustments and keep score. But as Professor Campbell, formerly of UCLA, reminds us, the paleontologist cannot do any of that. He cannot observe processes, but only results. He has no regular sequence of pictures before his eyes, but only a few badly blurred snapshots of the Earth over the last 3 million years. Studying these, the specialists try to tell us just what happened. Am I willing to stake my eternal salvation on their highly conflicting opinions? The little pictures are very few in number, very far apart, and very badly damaged. Every authority today emphasizes that more than ever before. In the place of connections between the specimens, we have only resemblances, and it is on them that we base our whole story. Classification, taxonomy, biosystematics, it is all a question of endlessly debated definitions, not a whit different from the harangues of the ancient sophists. In the same breath, the experts today emphasize the scarcity and bothersome overabundance of evidence, the paradox resulting from a sudden accumulation of evidence during the past decade. Upstairs in the old education building at Brigham Young University, there stood for many years a tall, thin glass showcase. On the top shelf was a human skull. Below it was the cast of a Cro-Magnon skull, then Neanderthal, and so on until we got to a skull of a gorilla. Here, before our very eyes, was an unimpeachable sermon on how man came to be. But things have changed now. As late as 1955, writes Professor B.G. Campbell, fossils could be fitted into a relatively simple and not very controversial phylogenetic lineage. The numerous fossils now known offer alternative interpretations. Not so compellingly simple as before, but how many alternative interpretations? The number of possible hypotheses are both theoretically and practically unlimited. J.J. Jerison wrote in 1975, "The simple picture of evolution from an Australopithecine to a Havilland to a Pithecanthropine to a sapient grade is obviously inadequate." He added rather wistfully, almost regretfully, "Things would actually fit together more easily if the dating of the new specimen at 2.8 million years ago were in error." The equally eminent D. Pilbeam comments on the same development. "Until a few years ago, relatively simple schemes that viewed past hominoids as foreshadows of living ones functioned very well as organizing paradigms. Today, classification of past forms on the basis of present-day distinctions may not be very useful. Interconnections among fossil species and between them and the present species are increasingly difficult to draw. Concern with phylogeny is perhaps on the wane. A great deal of heated debate has occurred over the past 10 years or so concerning hominid origins. The last decade has seen a number of significant changes. We are now in a period of uncertainty. This contrasts with the preceding period, during which much seems so clear-cut and obvious." The sensational new discoveries in Africa only remind the researchers how much they have been missing and how much they're still missing. "Whence came these late neogene hominoids?" asks Professor Pilbeam of the Olduvai population. The question remains unanswered because our knowledge of the fossil record is sparse and heavily skewed toward representation of jaws and teeth. And Professor Jelinek informs us that the entire excavated area of occupation surfaces all over the world is well under the size of a modern football field. At Olduvai, 80% of the material comes from a band of strata representing only 4% of the time span of occupation. As opposed to the certitudes that were the most characteristic, as well as the most obnoxious, trait of past generations of the Darwinian ministry, Campbell reminds us, "We know that we can never do more than present hypotheses on the basis of the presently available evidence. As time-bound creatures, no ultimate truth about the origin and evolution of mankind can ever be known to us." If nothing else, Professor Pilbeam concludes his study, "perhaps the only thing that is certain is that the next decade will provide us many surprises." If that is certain, we should, in all conscience, postpone any further discussion or debate on such matters for at least another 10 years. I could have saved myself a lot of trouble by simply ignoring the experts for 30 years. It is sad to think how many of those telling points that turned some of our best students away from the gospel have turned out to be dead wrong. Now, it is admitted, in the words of W.W. Howells, that all those years when everybody was sure of the answers, no scheme was presented that intelligibly interpreted the fossil record. And now the interpretation is far more difficult than ever, because there are just too many types to relate and explain. It is a strange fact, a paradoxical problem, as Pilbeam puts it, that the hominids are one of the poorest representative fossil mammal groups relative to their apparent past diversity. An astonishing number of different types are running around. There are 7 at Olduvai, and yet so very few specimens. What is wrong? It is no longer enough to fall back, as S. Washburn does, on the old chestnut, "Surely as more fossils are found," his tool theory, "will be found to have been a major factor." What kind of science is that, basing our theories on evidence not yet discovered? This is a reminder that those who study the origin of man begin with the final answers. The ultimate questions that can only be answered after all the returns are in are the very questions with which Lyell and Hutton and Darwin began their explorations. Our thrilling detective drama begins by telling us who did it, and then expects us to wait around with bated breath while the detective brings in the evidence. The premise is stated, for example, by G.G. Simpson. In the evolutionary pattern of thought, there is no longer need or room for the supernatural. The earth was not created, it evolved. So did all the animals and plants that inhabit it, including our human selves, mind and soul, as well as brain and body. So did religion. Well, if we grant that, we already have the answer to the big questions. We know the final score. And as giving the plot away spoils the fun, so Simpson must go back to the Bible whenever he wants to interest an audience. Here it is important to bring to attention the great number of knowledge banks that must be brought under contribution before we can get it all together. There was a time when the Bible was the only knowledge bank. Some fathers of the church, like Hillary, declared that anything not specifically stated to have happened in the Bible could not possibly have happened anywhere. When Aristotle's only knowledge bank became available, the doctors of the church diligently accommodated the Bible to his teachings. With the study of the heavens, the stars became the next great source of guidance to the real nature of things. Then Bacon opened the book of nature. Next, geology and biology called the tune. Geology took a direct look at the past. We had to believe what it told us, while biology examined the active processes that brought about the visible changes. On these two hung all the laws and the prophets. And why not? Where else could one turn for answers? It is an illusion to look elsewhere. Freud explained in a famous essay, The Future of an Illusion, for what other science is there except science? Duly impressed, the world failed to ask whether those data, no matter how concrete and precise, were adequate for the immense burden of proof that was needed. The prestige of science rested on shocking oversimplification and elaborate tautologies. Never mind the details, we were told. We can fill them in later, which means, as noted, that the great search for truth begins with the final answers. Darwin decided at the age of 20 that the Bible was a fraud. He claimed he felt no distress and never doubted for a single second that his conclusion was correct. In a disarming article, T. Dobzhansky admits that his own beliefs are based on anything but exhaustive evidence and that others with competent knowledge of that evidence do not agree with his conclusions. In other words, his model doesn't work, but that is no reason for rejecting it or looking for another model. After all, it is scientific. He has put a great deal of time and study into it. It is based on known facts and sound reasoning. Why should he give it up for gross superstition, mysticism, and ignorant religious ranting? There's always the assumption that there is no other alternative to my science but your anti-science. Your knowledge bank does not count if it obfuscates mine. As usual, Dobzhansky rests his case on discoveries yet to be made. Guessing where new discoveries are likely to be made is a risky venture in science, and yet a scientist is constantly forced to take this risk. True, and for that very reason, as Karl Popper reminds us, a scientist can never be dogmatic. But Dobzhansky is nothing but dogmatic. Well, again, why not? Here were the sciences which in time would give us all the answers. We are quite sure of that, so why not accept their conclusions now? That is just what the public has done, and the results have been paralyzing. The Darwinian sleep has done much more damage than the Newtonian sleep, a dullness of mind that cripples curiosity with the authority of the approved school solution. The two big questions today, Dobzhansky says, are, one, the mechanisms of evolution, the very question that Darwin was supposed to have answered for all time, and two, the biological uniqueness of man, which is the real Adam question. How do you define man? How do you define Adam? There were a lot of creatures running about long ago who looked like men, but for that matter, there are a lot of them today. You can go to the Hogel Zoo and see some of them, but they are not men. Are these zoo critters ancestral to us? No, for they are contemporary. And what about the other creatures who disappeared long ago? Are they ancestral to us? That is just the question. and there is no agreement on it. Since World War I, Homo erectus has been found all over the Old World, the term including a number of prehistoric types. Where did Homo erectus come from? Asks W.W. Howells. Where did he go? The paths are simply untraced. Above all, the nature of the line leading to living man remains a matter of pure theory. In September 1979, 150 of the world's leading paleontologists met at the 8th Pan-African Congress of Prehistory and Quaternary Studies in Nairobi. The main issue discussed was, what is the definition of Homo? How do you know a true man when you see him? Well, he looks like a man. Again, there are creatures in the zoo that look like men. In recent years, the old concept of a single, steadily evolving lineage from ape to man has been completely replaced by at least three and possibly more different forms of early man evolving simultaneously in Africa. By 2 million years ago, at least two forms of hominids were living, and one of them died out perhaps 1 million years ago. And the other? It was no more man-like than many of the others. What evidence have we that it did not also die out? Pilbeam writes that 300 individuals found in East Africa represent at least 7 hominid species. He also notes, these species do not resemble any of the living Old World higher primates. In fact, they seem to have been in many ways distinctly different from all later hominids. The tool-using dryopithecids disappear around 8 or 9 million years ago. The rhamphothecidae, about 8 million years ago. Campbell thinks they were related to us on a personal assessment of very complex and conflicting evidence, but he concedes that Leakey and Napier and others do not think Anthropus africanus was ancestral to H. habilis. A contemporary theory of great importance is that evolution has been directed and boosted through the ages as various hominid species have fortuitously adopted tools. After the initial innovation, the use of a particular tool could go on by simple imitation. Yet Washburn claims that tools have made us what we are. He tells us that the famous chopper tool remained in day-to-day use as a major element in the human toolkit for about 2 million years. One would think that 2 million years without a change would show quite remarkable immunity in these creatures to any didactic influence of the hand axe. Perhaps the nature of the instrument itself is to blame. In 1964, President Barnes of the American School in Beirut gave me what is perhaps the first Mousterian artifact ever recognized in Palestine, an excellent example of an Acheulean point, discovered by Frederick Bliss, the founder of the university at Bury El Qadr. What puzzles me is what it could have been used for it was of Marley Chert, and I doubt if it could cut cheese. When I dropped it from the height of about 9 inches on the tile floor, the top of the point broke off with the greatest of ease. So I was not surprised to read recently that while there is virtually no evidence of non-lithic tools for our pre-Adamites, and that these hand axes are the hallmark of most Middle Pleistocene cultures, prehistorians are still without firm evidence relating to the function of these first recognized and most elaborate of Lower Paleolithic stone tools. Hundreds and thousands of them, the standard all-purpose tool of 2 million years of diligent use. But what on earth were they used for? Yet Washburn assures us that thanks to such tools alone, the human way and the brain evolved together to produce ancient man of the genus Homo, about 500,000 years ago. Then the brain evolved under the pressure of more complex social life until the species Homo sapiens appeared, perhaps as recently as 50,000 years ago. Fortuitously discovered tools vigorously pushed man toward his full-blown glory, and yet 2 million years of that exhilarating process left not the slightest effect on their users. Just how powerful is the influence of the gadgets? Considerable academic debate surrounds the date for the appearance of modern man, Washburn tells us. By 35,000 years ago, however, the hunting populations of Western Europe were biologically indistinguishable from modern man. Yet he also tells us that man began when populations of apes, about 1 million years ago, started the bipedal tool-using way of life. In the same volume of essays, H. de Lumley reports on the 350,000-year-old village of Terra Amata, with its well-made huts, central heating, a hearth, and a special compartment for tool-making, the oldest known man-made structures. What kind of men? R.G. Klein tells us that modern man, Homo sapiens, seems to have made his first appearance between 45,000 and 35,000 years ago, and then goes on to describe one of some 100 Pleistocene sites in the Ukraine between 80,000 and 75,000 years old, where the people wore furs and beaded garments, buried their dead, and built substantial heated huts. The artifacts were Mousterian, and, to quote the same scientist, Mousterian artifacts invariably belong to Neanderthal man. But didn't Neanderthal man become extinct? Some say he did, some say he didn't. Which is it to be? 2 million years? 1 million years? 500,000 years? 50,000 years? Or 35,000 years? Each one introduces a new species, though all of them use tools. According to Klein, when true sapiens appears, it is with a sudden quantum advance in human culture evolution. By definition, evolution comes only by minute and gradual steps. A quantum advance must be something else. T. Dobzhansky, who lays particular emphasis on the tiny steps of microevolution, explains the anomaly by noting that culture brings an entirely new element into the picture. The cultural evolution of mankind is superimposed on its biological evolution. The causes of the former are non-biological. But once caused, he insists, they contribute to biological changes by natural selection. Genes determine the possibility of culture, but not its content, just as they determine the possibility of human speech, but not what is spoken. Whatever is behind it, it is the culture that marks the appearance of man as such, just as, by very definition, it is the written record that begins his history. When about 20 years ago it was decided that man himself is the chief conditioner of his evolution, scientists began to view him as outside and independent of the mainstream of organic evolution. Here was a new dimension, an evolution that no longer operated on blind chance. To define true man is to discover the uniqueness of man, that which he does not share with any other creature. It can only be his culture. And when do you get a real culture? Not until you get Adam. Those 100,000-year-old villages have nothing to tell us that we do not know. It is time we got to Adam. To recapitulate, religion has no plot. Science has no plot. This means that Joseph Smith is the only entry. He, at least, has given us a picture. But is it a convincing picture? The fact is, we have never looked at it closely. We have drawn back from that assignment, preferring to save a lot of trouble and take sides with the traditional schools. The stories of the Garden of Eden and the Flood have always furnished unbelievers with their best ammunition against believers because they are the easiest to visualize, popularize, and satirize of any Bible accounts. Everyone has seen a garden and been caught in a pouring rain. It requires no effort of imagination for a six-year-old to convert concise and straightforward Sunday school recitals into the vivid images that will stay with him for the rest of his life. These stories retain the form of the nursery tales they assume in the imaginations of small children, to be defended by grown-ups who refuse to distinguish between childlike faith and thinking as a child when it is time to put away childish things. It is equally easy and deceptive to fall into adolescent disillusionment and with one's emancipated teachers to smile tolerantly at the simple gullibility of bygone days, while passing stern moral judgment on the savage old God who damns Adam for eating the fruit he put in his way and, overreacting with impetuous violence, wipes out Noah's neighbors simply for making fun of his boat building on a fine summer's day. This is another case of what I have called the Gentile dilemma, or, if you will, the devil's dilemma. Joseph Smith gave the world something that nobody else could. That is why I say that Joseph Smith, with nothing going for him and everything going against him, simply could not lose. He told us what the play is all about. If you can come up with a better story than his, more power to you. But up until now, no one else has had any story at all to place before us. If only for that reason, I believe the process...